Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Continue to work hard and love the sport. Maybe 2% less.
Roger never had that be in the way of winning a match.
That's right, yep.
Carlos sometimes does.
Hi everybody and welcome to the Renee Subs Tennis Podcast. Well, guess what? I think it's time we start to think about renaming the podcast, because once again on the podcast is my buddy, one of my besties, Andreja Petković, of course, Petco. What do you think we should, send out a tweet or something? What should we call it?
No, we can, but nah. You know, I'm really happy with being on your podcast, so we can definitely keep it the way it is. And it's always just an honor for me being on the Renee Stubbs Tennis Podcast. But
how about this? How about Tennis with the Girls, or Tennis with Stubbsy and Petco, or something like that? And okay. Then we add in a little Caitlin every now and again.
Yes.
Huh? Because we don't want Caitlin to feel like she's been left out.
She's not left out. I said it before. I think we need her hot takes, especially on the political issues, because
she definitely gets right now.
Well, and I definitely think she gets the discussion going. She's like, if there is a huge fire going on, she will just drop another pound of oxygen onto it and maybe a few more matches. So I love that.
Now we maybe because I was feeling a little bit upset about the last situation where I was in the closet again. We're out of the closet. We are in your apartment though, but of course your boyfriend Jesse, who's like a miracle producer, music producer, can play every single friggin' instrument. It's kind of annoying. Has like set us up in your little— is this your lounge room with no couch?
Well, we just moved. Well, we lived here a little longer, but we subletted the apartment, and now we're on the lease, so we are very happy. But we don't have any furniture, basically, except for a table and a few chairs, and not even a bed frame. We just have a mattress, but we're working on it.
You are basically like— it's like you're college students.
It's a little bit like it, yeah. But we are working on it. We have ordered a couch. It's about to come in maybe 2 weeks. So the next time we're here, we can sit on a couch, and it will be very beautiful. Also, our apartment has— the walls are painted in literally all the colors that exist in the world, so we will also paint it. That's why we don't want to put too much stuff in, because it will be a pain to take it all out when we paint it, because we have a terracotta wall in the living room. We have salmon in the hallway. We have blue in the kitchen. It's a lot.
It's a disaster. Okay, I'm just going to be honest, but we'll take a photo for you, and we'll take a photo of the— what's this one? This is the—
this
rust.
This is the terracotta.
Terracotta. Guys, we'll show it to you, so don't worry. Anyway, so let's get to it. What a great couple of weeks out in Indian Wells. And may I say, what the F? Like, we had the plague of the bees. Like, obviously the best player of the 2 weeks was literally the beekeeper guy that came. I mean,
yeah.
I mean that guy just sucked those little suckers up and was like, all right, see ya, because you don't want to kill the bees, everybody. The bees are really important for us.
They are.
For our existence, okay? So no spraying them and killing them. You got to suck them up and you got to set them free somewhere else. So anyway, good job for the bee guy. But let's get into the tournament a little bit, Petco. One of the players that impressed you and you brought up to me before we get to sort of the main stage of the quarters and semis and everything, the finals, was Peyton Stearns.
Mm-hmm.
I want to give her a little credit for a great match against Sabalenka. Had a couple of match points against Sabalenka. A really good young player, and a kudos to college players coming out and really making a run, including Emma Navarro as well. So let's talk about those two in particular. Two young Americans, one feisty as hell, one that I want to play poker for me at every single tournament. Because
she has a poker face.
My
so
God,
true.
Like how great is her demeanor? But just a little bit on those two before we get going.
Well, so I, two things. I had the privilege to play Emma Navarro when I was playing in my last year, actually in Cincinnati. We played in the qualies against each other. Yeah, and I, after that match, I said, this girl is going to be really good. I had seen her in Charleston before when she was a wild card. Because famously her dad owns the tournament, but it was different already. You know, sometimes you have these wild cards where you're like, oh, this is this a Nepo is a- baby wild card. It was different with Emma. You could tell that she can play. Like you, it was nobody in the locker room was like, how did she get a wild card?
Yeah, like what a token wild card that is. What
you
a load of shit.
There was none of that. There was really none of that because this girl can really play. And now she's gotten so fit. I think she's lost 5-6 pounds of body weight. And it always has to be said when we talk about bodies here, this is a lot different than when we talk about bodies in general.
Yeah,
this
because
is not
she was
a
never,
sexual
she
thing.
She was never overweight. She was never like, looked out of shape. But comparative to what she used to look like, which was always a good athlete.
She was always fit, yes.
Now she looks like,
now she looks
whoa.
Lean and strong. Strong and really incredible. And I think this has to be emphasized that when we talk about bodies in tennis, it's, I actually wrote about this in my latest Substack. When we talk about bodies in tennis, we talk about it as a tool, right? So it's not like bodies in general where you're like, oh, you know, were we body shaming? It's just about as a tool. You saw it with Aryna Sabalenka before she won the Australian Open for the first time. She too lost 4 or 5 pounds in body fat and just got a bit lighter. It takes off weight. I had to do the same when I got issues with my knees, I had to lose it. So it's more like a tool that you have to readjust. Sometimes you have to gain muscle, sometimes you have to lose muscle. There's like all these things that play a part in an athlete's life, right? You probably know that too. I mean, you always were a great athlete, but you probably knew that too.
You look back at me when I was like 22, 23, and I didn't look chubby, but I was definitely a little bit, had that baby fat, you know, and then all of a sudden, you know, 10 years later, like when I was 30, I looked like I was in way, way, way better shape and I was like fit and ripped. But that's not happening anymore. But like somebody like Grigor Dimitrov, for example, he when he went through his long COVID, he really struggled to put on weight.
Yeah,
because
he
couldn't get in the gym.
He was always skinny, but he looked
gaunt.
Really, yes.
Now when I see him, his chest is a little bit stronger. He's a little bit bigger. So for him, he put on muscle. Like Nick Kyrgios, you know, when he had that great year, made the finals of Wimbledon, all of a sudden it went from a little bit soft to you could tell that he had been working really hard. And so that's sort of the definitions of what we're talking about. It's not necessarily, oh, they're fat.
Yeah,
no,
exactly.
It's they are, you can tell that they've put in that little bit of extra time on the court and in the gym.
Or that they changed something. That's also something, for example, for me, just taking a personal example, when I had to lose that weight, I just took a bit off my weights and worked in a different manner. I didn't necessarily change
heavy
the hours.
Weights, you're
yes, the heavy weights. I just changed a little bit. I used more rubber bands. I
thought you were going to say you stopped taking that one croissant extra in the morning.
Yeah, that would be nice if that was all it took. No, I really had to adjust. It was a trial and error for a while because my knees were not getting better. It was chronic pain and I needed to lose weight on the upper body. Also, that's not easy, like how you losing weight on the upper body, not on the lower body. So it was a trial and error period. And so Emma definitely did something in the off season that put her on the next level as an athlete. And she looks amazing. The thing with her is she doesn't really have a weakness.
No.
It used to be a little bit on, I played on a really quick court against her. When you got into her forehand, quick and hard, yes, and deep, she would be late and she would like, she wouldn't necessarily miss it, but she would get short and lift
and then,
it. And
then
you could
kill it.
Yes. And then you could go in.
And her forehand, what I noticed, because when I watched her last year at the US Open, when she wasn't quite as fit, was also her forehand tended to go cross court a lot.
Yeah, she would play a lot of cross court.
And I was thinking to myself, is that just her favorite shot? Or, you know, it's also a very good shot to have forehand cross court. But what I noticed over the last couple of weeks and actually months since she's been doing well, she's hitting her inside out forehand and her forehand down the line really, really well now. So now there's no, just you can't really read her forehand.
And
I mean, she's not a big girl. She's like, what, maybe 5'7"?
She has a great serve.
Maybe, but you know, for somebody her height, really, really good technique on everything. And you know, I just want to say something about, like, you know, when you're coming from a family of significant wealth, which she is, and someone like Jess Pegula as well, it's really nice to see that these two are two of the most grounded, nicest, hardworking two women that we have on tour. and they are gracious and fantastic for the sport. And I just give them a lot of kudos for being just really great kids.
I think this is a great point that you make, because I was going to make that point because you brought up college tennis. I think a lot of this is credited to college tennis, not necessarily because Jess didn't play college tennis.
But her sister did.
Her sister, and I do think that American, because it's not a coincidence that all the way, so this is always what's so fascinating to me about tennis. It's still kind of an elite sport, or people view it as that, especially from the outside. People think, oh, this is a white sport for wealthy people, for waspy people. But the tennis players who make it rarely ever are from really wealthy families.
Yeah, because they don't really have to be. And it's bloody hard to be a professional tennis player.
It's really, really hard. Yes. And so many, almost, I would say out of the top 100, almost everyone comes from a middle class, maybe lower class, whatever lower class means. But they come from not a lot, right? And they fight their way through. It's not a coincidence to me that three of the wealthiest kids from good families, Taylor Fritz, Jess Pegula, and Emma Navarro, are from America, because the competitive sport has a completely different value in America, and it gets imprinted on these kids from early on through high school tennis, college tennis, just the way sports is regarded in America. And I don't think that's necessarily a coincidence. I think it just speaks to, and there are many things we can talk about America that are not going well, but I think but I think the way it regards its sports and the way it brings up athletes, because I knew when I was a teenager and I played an American girl, I knew they were going to be the best competitors. Whether they could slide on clay or play well, that was not really...
They were going to fight.
Yeah, that was not really up for... That was a different thing, but it was never up to debate that they were not going to compete their hardest, try their best, and be really professional in how they conduct themselves. And this brings me back to Peyton Stearns, because I called her match last year at the US Open, where she also played a good match, lost in three sets to... who was it? It will come to me. To a good player. She lost in three sets, won a set, and was doing really well. I think Vondrousova, actually.
Yeah, it was Vondrousova. That was.
And
on.
She was already showing all what she showed against Sabalenka. She was just a little bit all over the place. You could see she didn't have a structure. She didn't really know how to put herself in the best position to use her forehand from the center of the court. And now all of the sudden it seems, and that's work. That's just work when you start to learn when to use which shot to put yourself in the best position.
Yeah. Yeah, and she's a fantastic competitor. They're very different. She shows all the, you know, pumping of the fists and, you know, yelling and screaming, come on, and all that. And then you got Emma down, the, you know, it's completely the opposite, like super quiet, never. I think you and I said when she beat Sabalenka, it's probably the most excited we've ever seen her.
Yeah, just a little smile.
She did like a little smile and a little bit of a fist pump, and I was like, what a classic. I wish I could have been like that. But when
I saw that, I was like, wow, what an emotional opera. Calm down, girl.
I don't know who's not worse. That's not the right way to the terminology I want to use, but it's like it's a competition between Rybakina and Emma Navarro who gets more excited when they win. But anyway, that was just a great little surprise for me. Good young Americans doing really well that have gone through the route of playing college. And obviously my old doubles partner Lisa Raymond was one of those types of players that dominated in college, like these two did. They both dominated, won the NCAAs, and then they said, you know what, I'm ready to go out now. So just a little thing out there for people that listen to our podcast, that have kids that, you know, are oscillating between whether to turn pro or to give it a go. Please emphasize, if they're not 100%, you know, physically ready, and as Emma wasn't, maybe, you know, as Peyton wasn't, send them to college for a couple of years. Give them the opportunity to spend time around their peers. And college tennis is really hard work. They're working, they're going to school, like it's a full-on job. From 7 in the morning till 7 p.m. at night, they're either going to school, on the tennis court, in the gym. It's really hard. If you want to be good, if you decide you want to be good, going to college for a couple of years and getting that opportunity to compete every day, you know,
so many
is
matches.
So important. Because one of the things that you guys in Europe get, that we in Australia, for example, don't get, and even maybe here in the U.S. don't get, is easy competition. Where you're playing matches. You play club tennis. You know, you look at the Czech women.
Yeah.
The reason why the Czech women are so friggin' good, and there's so many of them, is because they play against each other every weekend at home.
Yeah.
I mean, what? Are you kidding me? Like, they're so lucky that, and they hate losing to each other. So they are facing each other all the time. So my suggestion is, if your kid isn't Coco Gauff, okay, at 15 and winning matches against pros at 15 and 16, send them to college, give them a year or two and then let them free. Danielle Collins, there's so many that we can
Diana Schneider.
Yeah. Like, there's so many. There's probably way more that we're forgetting about. But anyway, I just want to give kudos to them and to college tennis and way to go. So, look, we have to talk about the week, the tournament of course, Maria Sakkari. Great couple of weeks, changes coaches. And, you know, I want to put it on the record that I like Tom Hill, her old coach, really nice guy, but very inexperienced. He came out of playing college tennis himself. He was a hitting partner for her at the beginning, and I think they became friends. And I think he certainly helped her in a lot of ways. She's very talented, great player. We all know that. And I think they became so comfortable with each other as friends that started to cloud the coaching aspect of it. And I'm sure Tom was probably sitting there watching her play these last 2 weeks going, mother, why couldn't you act like this around me? Well, Tom, unfortunately, I think when you go into coaching somebody who's quite volatile like Maria is, and not off the court, Maria is the nicest girl you could ever meet, but she is very volatile on the court and she's screaming and yelling at you. That's the time that you have to pull yourself away and go, it's not working anymore. You cannot be yelling and screaming at me. I cannot be the distraction when you're on the tennis court. And if I'm telling you to calm down and you're telling me to fuck off, essentially, which is what was happening there for a while, that's not a working environment that's positive for both. And I think David coming in, David's just the most relaxed, quiet, doesn't give a fuck kind of person. And that's the type of person that she obviously needed to look at when she was about to lose her mind, which she probably would have a couple of times in this tournament. And he's sitting there giving her absolutely no energy. And so she has to then decide how she's going to react to what's happening in front of her. And you could tell she just, I tweeted it out. It's amazing what Maria Sakkari can do when she can keep her shit together. But I do have a little bit of a fault for her in the final, but we're going to get to that. But what do you think about her through the 10 days of the competition?
So I think you're actually spot on. There is not much that I can add. The only thing that I will say, sign 1,000,000%. I think they got too close, if that's possible. Yeah. And that's a terrible thing, because I'm sure she was so happy to have somebody by her side who is her friend and coach in this really lonely tennis world where you travel 40 weeks a year and you're never home and you're away from friends and family. So that is great if you can be friends with your coach. However, the threshold of abusing is maybe a strong word.
Because I just thought about it, because I was like, how is my reactions and how is Sam? Well, Sam's a very different person, but Sam and I are as close as two friends could be. And I was her coach. And I was thinking, how would I have reacted in that situation? Well, first of all, Sam would never have spoken to me like that.
Okay, Sam
because
is
I'll
extreme.
Tell you why,
she's
though.
So, yeah.
No, because Sam can snap sometimes. She's an Aries like me. There's times where she will tell me to calm the farm. Oh, that's where I get the saying from, was from Sam. Because I'd be getting a little bit heated and she'd be like, Subsy, calm the farm. But it was respect. Sam had respect for me. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's where Maria lost the respect for anything Tom was saying in the end. And that's not a slight against Tom. That's just a slight against their relationship had gone and run its course.
Well, and I think it has to be said, because Greece is kind of on the Balkan adjacent from that area in Europe.
As she said in the speech, Greece is a pretty great country.
It is a great country. And my parents are from back then Yugoslavia. It's very close. And the culture is very similar. The family is very close. Yeah. And a lot of impulsivity, and you let it out on your closest people. You know, on the outside you keep a facade up, you're always nice, you're always respectful, but on the inside is where you let it out. And I think Tom became a part of the inside.
Yeah, that's a good
point.
And
and he was part of the family, which is great for them in terms of relationship, private relationship, but it's tough when it's a coach player relationship. I think David Witt really balances her out, because she's high strung. She's super high strung. And it seems like if you have a scale from 1 to 10, and 10 is overexcited and super high energy, and 1 is David Witt, they are exactly the two opposite. You know, like David is 1 and Maria is 10. And so they meet somewhere in the middle. They balance each other out. And I think that is really, really important for her. I do think, and this is something that Maria has struggled with for a long time, she's such a perfectionist. She's so hard on herself. And for the first time in a long time, I saw Maria play a tournament. smile and not have any expectations.
Yeah.
Because it's a new team.
Yeah.
It's a fresh voice. And I'm sure David said, let's try a few things out and see where it takes us. And now let's see how this continues. Because I do think that the expectations are the thing that make a high-strung person even more high-strung, if that's even possible.
For sure.
And that's where all this stress comes out, and that she kind of guided or arrow towards Tom, and who he was the one who had to take it all in. And so if she can stay in this mindset of let's take it day by day, let's see what we can do, let's try a few things out, let's try what
isn't there.
And if she can keep up that, I think she will have a great season. I'm just worried that that's the root of her problems, that she's such a perfectionist and so has so much expectations that can sometimes be in the way. And the reason why I say it is I identify very much. I was never the player that Maria was, but I had that too. And whenever I did well, my ex, like I would play semifinals in Miami, and I would all of a sudden expect myself to win all the clay court tournaments. It was never realistic. It was not like, oh, I played semis, now I should do well in Charleston, let's see how far I can take it. No, I have to win Charleston, Rome, Madrid, and Paris. You know, weird.
I mean, I don't mind that. I don't mind wanting to, you know, continually to win, but you have to look at it realistically and be like, but if I don't win them, why?
Mm-hmm.
And can I evaluate that without being, without destroying myself?
Yeah, yeah,
right.
Yeah.
That's the most important thing. And also I think I did notice after the semifinal, which looked like it could have gone either way there, that David, after the match, when she looked at him, he pointed at his head and he kind of gave the gesture. I can't show it to you on air, but on the podcast, but it's like he pointed two fingers at his temples and he kind of went like, you know,
mind exploding.
Oh, like when you control yourself, look what happens. And she looked back at him and went like, you know, the emoji where your brain is coming off. Like, oh, wow. That's what happens when I control myself. Mm. The one aspect that I wasn't happy with.
Yes.
So let's get to the final. You know, Iga, first of all, was just outstanding the entire 2 weeks. I mean, when she gets a role, I mean, the bakery was out. The bagels were coming left and right at this tournament. It was unbelievable. The toughest match she faced was against Wozniacki at 4-1. And I think it's because Wozniacki makes her play so many balls.
Mm.
And I saw them practice actually at the US Open last year. And Wozniacki was beating her on the practice court
at
the US Open because she makes so many balls. And if Iga's just a little bit off, she gets a bit anxious. Talk about a perfectionist.
Yeah.
And you're making the mistakes, and Caro's just there going, there's another error, another error. I'm here all day. But obviously she was dealing with a bit of a leg issue. But besides that, Iga was unbelievable. But in the final, the thing that I was a little upset at, it was two things that I want Maria to work. If I was working with her, in that situation, you know that if you play at your best, you probably still lose. Right? Because as good as you play and as great an athlete as you are, Iga Świątek is better under the pressure. She knows how to continue to play her A game when her A game is on. And she was on yesterday. And there was that period where she went from up 3-1 to 3-all, you know, so it was like, oh, it would look like Iga was going to run away with the final, like one in love. Mm-hmm. I mean, the way she was playing. And then all of a sudden, a couple of mistakes, missed a couple of balls here and there. And Maria kept her shit together. And then it was 3-all. And then, oh, it's a 4-all. Okay, this is a match now. And then it gets to 5-4. And then Maria just makes two or three unforced errors. Bang, 6-4 set, bang, over.
And then it was
and that's, Iga's just like, I'm playing the same way. I'm not going to make the errors. You know, when it got to 3-all, she was very calm. Her group was very good at keeping her relaxed. But the thing that I would like to see Maria in those situations, in that particular match, and I know she can do this, and I've told you this before, I think she needs to work on her slice backhand. Now, I wouldn't say, you know, that to Naomi Osaka. I'm not going to say that to Iga, right? But like you implemented the slice from time to time to get yourself back into the point. And the thing with Maria is that she can slice. I think her slice can be much better. Her footwork doesn't work with it. She opens up too early. There's a lot of technical things I could go into. But I think if she learned to slice her backhand a little bit to get back, because she's so athletic, to get back into the point without hitting it hard. So if you imagine people, you're outside the doubles alley and you're having to hit that backhand to Iga Świątek. Where do you go? Do you go line? You're dead. She hits a forehand cross court. You're done. Do you go back cross court hard and do a kind of a Kim Clijsters type of shot back into the corner, something you would do, and neutralize? No, because she can still go bang down the line with her backhand, even off a deep backhand. When you're hitting the ball hard to her, you're dead. Like, she is going to, especially on a slow hard court, like that is at Indian Wells. So there's one player that used to just literally, and no, like, it's the perfect word to use, chop Iga, was Ash Barty. Because Ash would hit the slice into positions on the court low under the net and put Iga into, you know, difficult situations where she had to hit and come in or hit and get back or utilize, you know, her grip is very extreme. So unless she's feeling really, really comfortable, that's a very hard shot for her to hit. So I don't understand why, you know, when you play, and this is what the great players do, like Novak, we've talked about it, Rafa, Medvedev, he stood up on the baseline when he knows he's going to have to play against a guy that whatever, you know, it's like, you have to adapt your game to playing against certain players. Mm. And so why not throw in a little uncomfortable slice from time to time? And also what you don't understand about a slice is you can knife it and hit it hard, or you can hit it soft and floaty deep, right? So that allows you to get back into the court, right? And Maria's so athletic. As long as she's back in the middle of the court, she can probably get back into the point. And hitting the ball hard is not necessarily going to help you because now the ball's back onto Iga's grip. She's like ready for it. And then the whole court is open and she's the greatest thing about Iga, when there's a space, she fucking hits it. She doesn't go, oh God, there's the opening, push it, like set point. She had a forehand that was, you know, without pressure, is a relatively easy forehand for her. It was on the baseline. Maria was off the court. The whole line was open. Now, a lot of players, as you know, Petko, you know this shot. You're like, oh my God, the whole line. Do I go for it or do I hit it there and not miss it? And she just stepped in and went whack and hit a clean winner down the line. And I'm like, God damn, that's so good. After going from love 40, so Maria was down love 40, got it back to 30-40 to go 5-all, okay? And so you're thinking, is Iga going to get tied here? Nope, at 30-40, when she had one more break point or set point, she goes crack with the forehand down the line. And so those are little things that Maria, I think, can get better at understanding how do I play against certain players that like my heavy hitting style of tennis. And her heavy forehand, which when she hits it with spin, as you know, it gets up there high. But on Iga, done, because that's actually where she's very comfortable.
Yeah.
So how do you get the ball into positions where Iga doesn't like it? And for me, she needs to work on her slice backhand. And I think if she can do that, she will win. She could win those types of matches, but until then. And also in the second set, 6-love. Like, come on. And that's one thing I do say with Dave, because he is so relaxed and laid back. That's where you as a coach have got to stand up and be like, are you quitting? Are you quitting on me? You got to stand up and be like, come on. No, now's the time to fight. You know, and maybe give her a little bit of, I'm sure he was telling her somewhat too, but he's not super, super active with the talking, which is good for her. But there are times where you got to be like, let's go. Are you quitting on me? Because for her to lose the second set 6-love, for me, as good as Iga was playing, you got to find a way to win games.
Mm.
Sorry, you do, especially with a good serve.
Well, yeah. So I think two things. I think the way to beat Iga on, to beat her is maybe a strong word, when she's playing well on a surface that suits her well, to push her is either to rush her like Rybakina or Sabalenka can, or to play low balls like slices.
Yeah.
If you play high spin balls, it doesn't really, because her forehand, Iga's forehand is the best forehand in the world when she has a bit of time.
Oh yeah.
It can go off on her. That's why she hasn't quite figured out how to play on grass yet, when you play into it deep and flat, right?
Yeah.
Because of the extreme grip. Yeah. Or a slice, because of the extreme grip, it's hard to get underneath it. And I think the way Maria plays, the way Coco plays, they kind of play into the perfect matchup that Iga likes. They play a flat backhand. She likes the flat backhand, you know. I think if you could lift it over the backhand, she might get into problems.
Maybe. But
that's what Ash used to do with the inside-out forehand over Iga's. She wouldn't, like, miss it, but she would maybe put it a bit shorter into the court. But they play flat into the backhand, which Iga likes, and they rotate into the forehand, which Iga also likes. So you have to kind of adjust. And I think one other thing with Maria, which she hasn't mastered it 100% when she's not feeling well, she doesn't have a great backhand down the line. She has the best backhand cross court in the world, maybe, because she can play it flat and short and so good.
Coco's pretty good.
No, but Coco can play down the line. She has the best backhand, period. But Maria's backhand cross court is maybe the best in the world. But she cannot hit it. That's why she had trouble with Coco, because she was a much better player. But she couldn't get it down the line. It would always go kind of in the middle, you know? And if she can get that, I think that would be another way to rush Iga on the forehand. If she could get that flat backhand cross court that she has also down the line, that would be another way to bother Iga with that extreme grip. But I think just matchup wise, it's a tough one for Maria. She would have to play against a few of her instincts. Just two more sentences to Iga and one more sentence to Maria. Maria, I think what I liked most about just strictly about her game, let's take the mental aspect out of it, just about her game, she used her physicality. Sometimes she rushes,
yep.
Or she used to rush before David came in, let's just put it that way. And I'm thinking, if you're not feeling the ball, just run and put it in. You're the most athletic person. You're the most athletic woman out there. The other ones will break if you just keep the intensity until you find your rhythm, and then you can crush it again. And she did that much better. Now when she was not feeling the ball, when she missed a few, she would take a step back, rotate it in, run balls down, use her athleticism until she found her rhythm again, and then go for it. And about Iga, Iga should probably only lose two or three matches in Indian Wells over the period of the next 10 years. It's the perfect surface for her.
And I said yesterday, I think Iga can win 8 French Opens.
Yes, French Open and Indian Wells, it's insane. It's so hard because, as we just said, there are two ways to bother her.
She can win more than 8, but I think she can win at least 8. French Opens.
Because that's the two ways you can bother her, is either you play slice, there are not a lot of people who play slice on the WTA Tour, or you rush her, and that's really hard to do in Indian Wells and clay, especially Iga playing at night most of the matches, where during the night it's even harder to rush her. And I will say one thing, and I'm so happy for her, because this was such a risk. She has, and we talked about this with Jannik Sinner, she has worked on her serve, and they did a bunch of few things, taking it up early, taking it down, doing this, doing that, and it's not perfect yet, but she, a few times in during Indian Wells and important moments, she just got 2 free points on her serve, and I was like, girl, she's the number one in the world, she's won so many slams already, she's only 21 years old, and she goes and tinkers with one of the most important shots in tennis.
Well, it's arguably the most important.
I tip my hat to that, to have that courage and have that to just go ahead and do that and have that boldness, and it's finally starting to pay off for her. I think she will still need a bit of time, but eventually we might see the same thing that happened for Sinner, where all of a sudden he found the shot and now he's almost unbeatable.
Yeah, I think with the serve, I would still like her not to have that pause. And I know they abbreviated the start of it, but they showed.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A side-by-side of that on Tennis Channel, and the start is obviously different, not dropping the racket head down, it's just going straight up, but in actual fact, once it gets into the trophy position, it's the exact same serve. It was like exactly, maybe a little bit quicker up to it, but that could also arguably just be the one that they showed, but they are exactly the same serve. So what I would like to see, if I was, you know, tinkering around with it, I would like to have her have a little bit more fluidity. Because at her height, it should be more fluid. And I think she needs a little more wrist snap. And she brings her right side too early into open, into a sort of like a... She brings her right side over too early, I think. If she kept that back a little bit and got her left hip out a little bit more and sort of got that, like, it's kind of like a bow and arrow type of positioning with your body to be able to accelerate, I think that would make her serve even better. So you're right, though. But I love seeing the best players tinkering to make it better.
Yes, that's what I mean. I think more the... I think the attitude of it is more than, I think it's still a work in progress. And I said it, I think it's a work in progress. But I think just the boldness to go ahead, being the best player in the world, and she could have stayed the best player in the world for a long time. It would have been tougher, but
the second serve is still attackable, though.
It's still attackable,
so
definitely.
She needs to...
The first serve still goes off, and she had that problem before, too, where she would serve well, and then for four games, she can't find a first serve. That's the one thing, but because she's so good, and on clay, she neutralizes the next shot so well, it doesn't really matter for her. But, you know, I love the boldness of... I think I'm talking more about the mentality and the attitude of having the boldness to go ahead and tinker with a shot even though you're already the best player in the world.
Well, can we talk a little bit then, and I wasn't going to talk about this, but now that you brought it up, Coco, because her second serve is effing a woeful at the moment. I mean, she is double folding up a storm. And I, man, listen, I could not love a kid more than this kid. I mean, she is such a fighter. I mean, the professionalism.
I think she's the best competitor on the WTA
Tour. She is such a great competitor. It's unreal. Even when she is playing her C-minus game, she's never going to quit, this kid. And she won matches this tournament that she probably shouldn't have. And only because she has such a fighting spirit. But her second serve is so, it's so unreliable, you know? And she's dropping the left side of her body down. It's like it's very similar to the way Venus missed her serve. You know, that whole left side of her arm drops down, her ball goes into the net, her grip is all messed up. But also, and, you know, in the forehand, we know, we've talked about that. But, you know, and I don't want to give Brad too much shit, but, like, you can't say at the Australian Open that you're not going to touch her forehand. Like, he was asked on air by Chris McKendry, you know, well, you know, obviously, look, her forehand's still breaking down, you know, is there things that you're working on with it? And he put his hand up and said, zero. And I'm like, come on, man, you can't be a coach and say you're not going to work on someone's weakness. You can't say that. And as much as he's helped her in so many ways, you have to say her forehand and her second serve is letting her down. So what are you doing in regards to that? And as far as I'm concerned, until she gets those more reliable, which is what she was doing through the US Open swing. You know, when she won the US Open, there was no obvious weaknesses that were coming to the fore.
No, you're absolutely right. She didn't miss a forehand.
No.
She wasn't hitting winners. She wasn't hitting missing, like Sabalenka.
She wasn't
forehand.
Hitting 10 double faults a match, which is what she's doing right
and
now.
And she was not missing the forehand. It was, I think, people underestimate. Just because you don't hit winners doesn't mean that's a weak shot.
Yeah.
And she has a natural change of
rhythm.
Well, and she has, but that forehand is not. It's worse than Coco's in a way.
Yeah,
because
but she doesn't miss it.
That's true when she was playing her best, especially. But with Coco, she has a very natural change of rhythm in her game because the forehand is so heavy and the backhand is so flat. I've played with her many times. It's so uncomfortable to play, but if she misses it, that all goes to shite because it doesn't matter that she has a natural change of rhythm in her game when you miss the forehand. But during the US series, she wasn't missing it. So what do? Where do you go? You go into the forehand, it jumps over your shoulder. You can't do anything with it. You go into the backhand, smack.
Dead. Yeah.
You're dead. So where do you go?
Well, I'll tell you where
you go. And that's why she won all these tournaments.
You wait for double faults because she's dropping serve left and right, and that's what's hurting her. So as much as we talk about her forehand, I think the issue is her second serve.
Well,
that's what she needs to improve.
I'm interested in hearing what your take on this is, what I think, because I've called a few of her matches at the Australian Open courtside, and you really see what's happening. And they did one thing that has gained her 10 miles per hour on average more on her first serve, but is also her downfall on the second serve. They shortened her ball toss and put it a bit more to the front, which is great to get more boom on it, but which is terrible for getting any
serve.
Slice or kick on it. And she used to have a good kick serve. Not a great kick, but a good kick serve. When you throw it in front of you and short, there is no way you can get any acceleration on it or spin on slice. And I think that's what has helped her in the first serve, I think, is kind of her downfall right now with the second serve.
The short ball toss is absolutely fine. It's not the short ball toss. The short ball toss is actually good. You know, get up there and smack the shit out of the first serve. The problem with the short ball toss on the second serve is if it is in front of you at 1 p.m. So think about a clock, all right, everybody. If you're throwing the ball toss to 1 p.m., you cannot hit a kick serve. So every second serve is in the middle of the box to the forehand side on average. So unless she gets the ball toss back, and if you think about the greatest kick serve of all time in women's tennis is Sam Stosur, and her ball toss was tiny. You played against Sam. It was very, very short, you know, but she got underneath it. So she needs to learn to hit at about 7 p.m. on the ball and the ball needs to be behind her head. So when you throw the ball toss up, everyone, if it doesn't land behind you, it's not a good kick serve toss. You cannot hit a kick serve without the ball toss being either at literally 12 p.m. is at marginally fine. But ideally, you want to be throwing it at like 11 a.m. And I know I'm throwing a lot of numbers out, but if you think of the way a clock is, if you throw it at 11 a.m. or 10 a.m. even, and you look at the great kick serves, it's behind them. And so if they let the ball bounce, it will literally come down behind their body. And that's what she needs to work on. The short ball toss is fine. It's got to come back. And I don't understand how she hasn't worked on that. And I say this with so much love because I could not like this girl anymore, but I want to see the reliability on that serve because that's what's hurting her. And that's what, in my opinion, that's what hurt her in this match. Because if she's winning her service games, the forehand won't get as tight because she's like, I know I'm going to hold serve. It's no big deal. And for me, like Serena, then the serve would go off.
And that matchup is good for her, Sakkari, normally, because she has a little bit more time. Because Sakkari's forehand has a bit of tough spin. And she's
athletic.
Yes.
If not more.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is amazing to say when you're talking about Maria Sakkari. Anyway.
Well, yeah, we'll see how that progresses for her.
And Sabalenka, before we get off the chickies, Sabalenka, what is going on here? She didn't win in the Middle East. She did not do well in Indian Wells for her standards, losing to Emma Navarro, who's a great player. We already know that, and who is now a top 20 player in the world. So well done on that, Emma. But what's going on here?
That's really interesting. I don't know. I wonder what your take is. That's really interesting to me because I thought in Australia she was so much ahead of the pack.
Yes.
So much. It wasn't like she was a bit better than everyone. She was like a full level above everybody else. So I thought even if after the winning the Australian Open, she drops a little bit, she will still be among the best in the world for the next few months. And then all of a sudden, it just went off again. And that's the thing and the beauty and the tragedy with Aryna Sabalenka. No matter how well she plays, it can go off the next day. So you can never really bet on her, even though I was convinced at the Australian Open.
You were.
I was convinced she was going, and maybe she's just focusing on the Grand Slams. Who knows?
Know.
Maybe she found a way how to prep for the Australian Open. And the hardest thing in tennis, we talked about this so many times, is the scheduling aspect of it. And maybe she was like, I peaked at the Australian Open. I know exactly what I did. And now I'm going to do exactly the same for the French, for Wimbledon, and for the US Open.
Maybe.
And if she does that, we will talk next year in September after the US Open. We will say, like, she knew way more than we did. And maybe she's just taking it as a role. And she's, because she was so close. We talked about this so many. She was so close. She had a shot at each and every major tournament
to win
them all. And maybe she was like, I was so close. I really want to pull this off. And maybe that's what she's doing, because otherwise it's really hard for me to explain. Maybe you have an explanation.
I don't have an explanation. I think she just, you know, there are times where the bullets are just flying out of the gun when they shouldn't be. And they're going out, you know, and she misses some random shots and you're like, well, what is that? You know, but then the focus is on and the game is there and then she's unbeatable. So I kind of love it though. I kind of love all this. I love Iga coming back and being like, oh, you thought you were going to be number one player in the world and da-da-da-da-da. And now here I win Middle East, Indian Wells. She'll probably win Miami because the court's quite slow there as well.
And I listen to our podcast during the Australian Open because I do my research and I try to be better so that we get better. So
you're a competitor. No, you are. Let's just fight.
No, but not in this actually. Only in tennis I'm competitive. But I want us to be better. So I listen to a few and wrote down things that we can be better at. But we did say at the last thing, this is the best thing that could have happened to Iga. She's going to be amazing the next 2 months because she can't stand seeing Aryna being that much better than the others. And so...
And what the hell with Rybakina getting stomach issues again and what gastro or whatever? I mean... What? Anyway, we don't even need to get into that. But
we already have 35 minutes and we still have the guys ahead of us.
Anyway, but anyway, the women's was great. Iga was just absolutely outstanding. It is perfect court for her, just as it is for Mr. Carlos Alcaraz. Carlos and Iga, similar players in a lot of ways. They're great athletes, but they love that just a little bit slower where they can just get around and crush forehands and all the things.
Slower and a bit higher bounce. I think that's what...
Which doesn't suit Mr. Medvedev.
No, it's amazing what he did. I mean, really, we will talk about it. It's amazing. But that's exactly the similarity you talk about, is exactly that. The Iga extreme grip, and for Carlos, the big swing on the forehand is why they like it to sit up a little bit, and why it's difficult for opponents to rush them into that shot. Because we saw what people did with Carlos Alcaraz, especially Zverev at the Australian Open, just ripping his backhand down the lines. Granted, Carlos just played into Zverev's backhand, which nobody understood.
Yeah.
But ripping the down the lines, and Carlos always being rushed on that forehand. And it's similar with Iga Świątek. So you're right. They are in different ways very similar.
Yeah, we saw the evolution of Carlos against Zverev, because you and I were watching the match at the Australian Open and yelling at the television.
So
going,
loudly.
Why in God's green earth are you playing one ball to Zverev's backhand? Like... I could not win one point against Zverev if I played him in a match, okay? Not one, for sure, unless he double-folded, which is possible, so I could win a point. but there's no chance I'd play one ball to that guy's backhand under pressure. And we were like, why are you playing to his backhand? It was almost like he was a stubborn little kid, like, I can still win there. And he's like, you could tell that his coach, Juan Carlos, was like, bro, and in Spanish, hit the ball to this guy's forehand.
Hermano.
Yeah, hit it to his forehand and you will win. And that's what happened. So that, but before we get to that, before we get to Sinner Alcaraz, the final, Novak. Now, granted, I know, you know, Novak probably knows, as does the world in a lot of occasions, the bro doesn't like to play in windy conditions, okay? He did not play. Anytime it's super windy and you're like, oh, this guy might have a chance. And if it's super windy, put some money on the other guy. Because when Andy Murray won the US Open against Novak in the final years and years ago, obviously, like decades ago, it was so windy that day, and Andy Murray is a king in the wind. Mm. King in the wind, because he uses a slice, he uses a little bit of this, a little bit of that, a little argy-bargy stuff, blah, blah, blah. Novak likes the pure ball.
And I think it's very underrated.
And it affects him.
Yeah, well, and I think it's underrated, or nobody ever talks about how clean of a ball striker Novak is.
Oh, it's amazing.
You have it in mind, because when he plays bad, he does this weird framing the forehand and then dramatically falling backwards, but that rarely ever happens. Yeah. He usually hits the ball in the middle of his strings every time. And you can be a clean ball striker without being necessarily a Lindsay Davenport who hits the shit out of the ball. You can still be very clean. And Novak always
hits it. And Lindsay dominated at Indian Wells.
Yes, but Novak always hits it cleanly and in front of him, even though he's not a big hitter like Lindsay is. I love that we just compared Lindsay and Novak Djokovic.
She'll love that.
Sorry, but carry on about Novak.
But he just struggles in the wind, and playing this kid, lucky loser, who's super talented. He played amazing.
This has to be said. He played out of his ass.
And Novak said in the press conference that he played like shit. And I have to say, that episode where he, you know, got upset at Nadi for like pretending not to play the point, dude, that was so...
He was wrong.
He was so wrong in that situation. Like, how many times have you played a point where you're like, geez, is it in? Is it out? Well, first of all, there's no linesman.
There's no linesman.
There's no call.
Exactly.
There's no call. And your opponent stands there like he doesn't care, which, by the way, everybody does. Everybody plays possum on the court sometimes to pretend they're like, oh, I don't care. And then they start running to the other direction of the ball. I mean, it's the Angie Kerber. Watch Andy Kerber do it like 1,000 times a match. And Novak's done it. Like, come on, man. If your opponent isn't playing, quote unquote, I'm putting in air quotes, playing the point, then crush him.
Mm.
And you looking at the guy, and then he gave him shit at the net. That was so unprofessional, in my opinion.
Cool.
You cannot be like, dude, you were wrong. Hey, but well done. It's like the poor kid. He was just like, the poor kid looked like he'd just been scolded by his dad. And he was just like, he didn't know whether to celebrate or be like, oh my God, this is the best day of my life. But my dad just told me I suck as a human being. I was like, oh, poor guy. Anyway, Novak, then he pulls out of Miami. Like, what is going on here, man?
So what I heard, and I don't want to say too much, what I heard from his camp is that he wasn't able to practice as much as he usually does before a tournament. And
because he was in LA at a basketball game?
I don't know. I don't want to say. I honestly don't know. Actually, I'm not trying to be secretive. I don't know. That's the only thing I heard. I reached out to a few Serbian friends and tried to figure out what was going on. And basically what I got back is he wasn't able to practice, whether that was physical or whatever else. I don't know. But that was what I got, that he wasn't able to practice as hard as he normally does. And he practices still really, really hard. And he hits a lot of balls. And I think the way he plays, he needs to hit a lot of balls to feel 100% secure in his game. And so that's just what I gathered. And I don't know if that's true. Again, it's nobody from Novak's camp directly. So this is just the talk, and this is all speculation, but that's what I heard. And so I think you could see it in his game, because sometimes I called Carl, I will never forget this, I called Carlos Alcaraz's first match after Wimbledon last year, and you could just see
that he hadn't been putting in
that
the work.
He had, but no, you could say like his body looked really buff, so you could see like, oh, after Wimbledon, yes, he was shanking it. And it was like, oh, he took a few days off, he partied, then he went to the gym,
he
and
went
then
to
started
Hopman Cup.
He did, but he like kind of, you know, played.
Yeah, but he played
loosey-goosey
on clay on Hopman Cup. Yes. And didn't give a shit, and then he went to Canada. I'm like, dude, you.
Yes, but you could see exactly. I knew, because from being in these positions so many times, I knew exactly what had happened. He had to take some time off because of Hopman Cup, because he's a good kid. He doesn't want to bail on his promises, so he went there. Regards go out to Ivan Majoli, who runs that tournament right now in Nice. So he went out there because he's a good kid and keeps his promises. Then he had to still take a break because it was a long, long period. Yeah. Remember, he had won the Queens as well. Yeah. So he had played a lot of tennis. So he had to take a break. Then he went to the gym because people were like, you're going to get injured if you don't train properly. So he went to the gym, but then started practicing 3 days before probably. And you could see he was just not feeling the ball. He was shanking his forehand. The serve was going everywhere. And I said it on air, and I was thinking about, should I say it or not? Because it
That's
kind of...
That's what your job is?
Well, but it's... throws a bad light, even though we know scheduling in tennis is so challenging. You have to take breaks. It's not about like being lazy and you can't. Sometimes you just have to take these sacrifices. And I just knew he hadn't hit enough balls.
Well, what I can tell you is that he would have learned a lot from last year.
Yeah.
Of how to schedule. And you do have to learn those things.
Yeah.
So maybe Novak's just like, you know what, I don't feel great.
And remember, he was sick at the Australian Open, so maybe he needed a longer break than usual. He is 37 years old.
Yeah, and he saw the video of Nadal banging his foot, showing everyone that he's going straight onto the clay to practice. I don't know, I'm speculating there, but interesting. But I tell you what, Sinner has picked up the mantle as the best player in the world, and it was questioned this week by Alcaraz. But I think it's so... They are so similar to Roger and Rafa because of, first of all, they're two great guys. I mean, it started raining and Carlos is standing there waiting for Sinner to get off the court. Like, they're smiling. They're like, they're so good for the sport, these guys. They're so good for the sport. But also, I think the court surface is going to determine a lot of who wins and who loses between those guys.
100%.
You know?
Like, and day form and conditions, basically.
If they play at night. What's the court surface they're playing on? Faster court is going to favor Sinner. A slower court is going to favor Alcaraz. So it's like, how can they, like Novak, Novak was able to do it on every surface, but the way that Nadal realized he had to step in a little bit more on grass against Roger, the way that Roger had to hit his backhand with a little bit more punch. Mm. There's all these things that they're going to have to learn because they know that those two are the ones that are going to be competing for the number one ranking in the world for the next 10 years. So how can they, which is so great because they are so great for the sport and they're such nice guys.
And they're so different, which is also
fun. Yeah, but the fact that they, I mean, that unbelievable point that Sinner won and they both turned around and looked at each other and started smiling and laughing.
Can I please ask, I was the only one. There was a double bounce.
No, it wasn't. No, they showed it on replay.
No, not that one. The one before. I'm 100% certain there was a double bounce on Jannik Sinner. And I looked at it and I saw it three times and just nobody mentioned it. They never showed a replay of it. And if anybody else saw it, please tell me I'm not delusional.
No
Thank
way.
You.
It wasn't a double bounce. And if anyone...
It was. I would...
All right, I'm going to go back and look at the film, but okay. I don't think it was. But anyway, besides that, these two are going to compete against each other for the next 10 years and plus, hopefully. And I'm here for it because it's great to see Alcaraz finally get through a tournament and not have an injury. And after coming back from hurting his ankle, you know, playing on the clay and then playing that Netflix thing and then coming, it was an amazing effort because, my God, he played that one point yesterday where he almost tripped over himself where the ball went over his head and then he turned around and managed to win the point. And you could see Medvedev getting more and more anxious because he's thinking to himself, oh my God, if I didn't win the point by now, there's no way I'm winning the point. And I'm at the net. What do I do? Oh my God, I'm going backwards. I'm trying to hit these shots. I can't volley the ball away. You could tell the anxiety level was rising so high in Medvedev when he was at the net that he was just like, if I could have paused it and someone said, who wins this point? Alcaraz is going to win this point for sure. But just a little thing on Medi, and I said this on Twitter. I don't know about you, Petco, but at the Australian Open, at the US Open last year, and again at Indian Wells, that skinny motherfucker gets the worst schedules. He gets the worst schedules every time. He was, when Serena played and I was coaching Serena, he was on after Serena every single match at the US Open 2 years ago or 3 years ago, whenever it was. And I kept, because we'd see each other the next day, and I was like, dude, so sorry about the schedule again. He's like, it's Serena, you know, it is what it is. Because, you know, normally they would flip-flop the guys. But you're never going to put Serena second on. She was always going to be at seven. And guess who had to play against after her every time? Medvedev. And he'd win like 1-2-1. But he'd be finishing at 1 a.m., getting home at, you know, trying to get to sleep by 3. Every single time and every Grand Slam, this guy gets the worst schedule. At the Australian Open, 3:45 in the morning, that motherfucker's playing till. And then even against Zverev, he's second on again. He finished at 1 o'clock in the morning. And the reason I know this is because I had to wait for him to interview him every time. So I'm like, every Grand Slam, this guy gets a shitty schedule. I don't know why they do it to him.
I know why.
Well, I know why too, because he's not quite as popular as Novak or Rafa or these guys.
Well, he's in the worst position you can be.
Yeah.
As a star, I'm putting quote unquote, if you're a star on the tennis tour, he's in the worst position. He's the number three in the world.
Yeah.
And he's always been number two or three in the world, which means there is one big star. He's Novak or now Sinner, or it was Alcaraz for a while, who will always get the prime time 7 p.m. schedule. But he's still a big star.
Of course.
You put him in a slot where you're like, not sure people will show up, but because it's Medvedev, they will.
Yeah.
And so he is, and that's in women's, it's the same. Look at the number three player in the world.
Yeah.
It's a little different in women because Coco is and Coco is such a big star on her own. But
like look a Jessica Gula or something.
Yes,
like that,
look at the other years when before Coco was the number three in the world. The three in the world.
Rybakina.
Is
second
in the
on every
yes,
time.
Yes, it's she's in the worst. He or she, they are always
they're
in
the
worst
to
position.
Finish over the last
always.
Couple of years. Rybakina in Canada, remember, with the rain and everything, 3:45 in the
And they think they take it so personal. It's not personal. It's the number three world ranking.
Yeah.
Don't be. This is the.
So get yourself to one.
Yes.
But even when he was one, he was getting screwed. But I'm telling you. And then, of course, Indian Wells, same thing. He played second on in semis. He finished at midnight. I know the rain didn't help, but he was the one that was second on. So he gets less time to recover, okay, for the final the next day again. Now, he came out a little bit. He came out on fire in the final because he was probably like, as he did in Australia, because he had zero. I mean, the guy had to be on zero in the tank at the Australian Open. Comes out firing, standing up on the baseline, ripping winners all over the place, acing, coming into the net, like being like, not a kamikaze, but like really being aggressive.
Yeah.
Same thing yesterday. Came out up on the baseline, not far back on the return, like crushing winners all over the place. And you're like, oh, damn, he knows. And also Jim Courier said, well, he's coming out because he knows, again, that he's probably got a little bit less energy. So he's taking it to Alcaraz, which he did. But then at some point, the legs go, and losing that first set killed him because there's no way on that court, the way Alcaraz plays, knowing that he beat also Zverev, Medvedev on the same court, I believe the year before. It's like he plays that game where it gets high on Medvedev's forehand and he's such an unbelievable athlete and Medvedev can't finish the point at the net because his volleys just aren't good enough. And it's like he had to win that first set to have a chance. And he just ran out of steam and then Alcaraz just ran from there. But I'm telling you, ATP, give the guy a break, man. I know at the French Open it's going to be a bit different and at Wimbledon it's a little bit different. But at the US Open and the Australian Open, I know he's number three player in the world and he's going to get screwed. But I feel so bad for him because he does get screwed.
But even if he's number one in the world, as long as there's Alcaraz and Sinner, you will always be just the next big star. It's unfortunate. But maybe if he dominates a while, and I think the year when he won all the US series tournaments, basically, he had a bit of a better scheduling, but not much. So yeah, that's unfortunately the fate of the number three player in the world. You will always be scheduled the
and
second night match.
And that match against Tommy was so good. And I mean, I got to give kudos to Tommy Paul.
He was playing amazing.
I just talk about tinkering with your game.
Yeah.
Tommy Paul has decided to, you know, go and, you know, set aside time to watch the masters of serving and volleying, the Boris Beckers, the Patrick Rafters, the Stefan Edbergs, these great serve and volley players that's all they did when they played, essentially, and study how they played those points. And I can tell you, as a serve and volleyer and somebody who was at the net, you know, 80% of the time when I played, is that you have to learn how to move forward, on what shot to move forward, how to rope and dope your opponent into hitting passing shots that you sell them where to hit the passing shot, right? So you stand in a certain position at the net, and at the last second you move to the open court, because everybody, like if I ran into the net on you and I was standing in a spot at the net and you saw all this opening in the cross court, you would hit it there, right? Most of the time. Maybe you would anticipate that maybe I'm going to rope a dope you, but most of the time, most players see space and hit it there. And so you have to learn how to, you know, basically bring the ball to you at the net and how to do that. And there's little moves that you can make. And he talked about it. He talked about, oh, I saw how he jukes at the net and how he moves. And I love that, because Tommy knows he doesn't make a lot of errors, particularly on that backhand. But it's like, and he's a great athlete, very similar to a Maria Sakkari. But he's like, how am I going to beat these guys? And chipping and charging, hitting and coming in, doing the saber, doing the Roger Federer move, serving and volleying, coming in, disrupting someone like Medvedev, which is what he did so well, and then just fell short a little bit, hurt his ankle in that tiebreak, which was such a bummer because it was a bad ankle sprain. He jumped in the air and came down like a basketball player. And it was brutal. And the poor guy, he got up and you could tell he was really struggling. But I want to just say to Tommy Paul and to Brad Stein and to his coaching, you know, crew, great job and implementing an extra layer into your game, which is what these guys have to do if they're going to beat the Alcarazes. And Alcaraz is a perfect example. Who implemented a drop shot in the last 3 years better than him? That's a new shot in tennis now. We all drop shotted, but this is now a shot. We've got to learn to hit a drop shot. I mean, that's what Roger Federer had to do to win the French Open, because everybody knew Roger would go to hit his forehand. It's like, oh, he's going to rip it. So you would just stand 20 feet behind the baseline like Rafa and just wait for the shot, run it down and bang. Instead, he started to implement a little forehand drop shot. And you're like, oh, shit, where does that come from? So implementing new shots are important for everybody to get better if they want to improve. Tinkering with the serve, Iga Świątek, Tommy Paul running into the net and improving his volley game. Amazing. And we're seeing it. I mean, remember when Rafa and Medvedev played the final of the French Open, US Open a couple of years ago, and they were both serving and volleying? I was like, what's happening here? Because they both knew to disrupt each other on the baseline, they have to be at the net. So I just love that from Tommy. He was unfortunate in the semis, but again, Medvedev, he just is so freaking gutsy. I have so much respect for him. And I know he gets a little stroppy on the court sometimes. Like yesterday, he was egging the crowd on because I think it's a little tough for him because people love Alcaraz so much that they don't give Medvedev any credit in a lot of way. And it's sort of hard to watch sometimes because same at the Australian Open with Sinner. It's like he doesn't get as much love as I think he deserves. And he does deserve it because he is such a warrior. I really like him as a player.
And I really have to say, and this makes me really angry, the way I didn't understand the extent of what Netflix has done to Medvedev's reputation.
Bullshit.
Until I talk to a few people who are not in tennis, because I'm so much in tennis that everyone I talked to was like, oh yeah, that was a bullshit portrayal and we moved on because we all know Medvedev is a great guy. But talking to people that are not in tennis that just watched this series and came up to me and was like, Medvedev is such an asshole. And I would be like, what? And they're like, he's the worst. I was like, don't ever say this ever again. Yeah. And it made me on like 3 months later, it makes me angry because at that time I just thought, oh, that
especially
was a
when
bad
it was
portrayal.
Zverev,
let's move on.
That they made Zverev look
well,
great.
Let's just put that aside. But you can't put one of the guys who's the most beloved on the ATP tour. And yes, he has weird quirks. Every player has, but that should tell you enough, except for Zverev. Every single ATP player in the top 100, so 98 out of 100 players love Daniil Medvedev. Yeah. In every single interview, they're like, who's the funniest? Medvedev. Who's the smartest? Medvedev. Yeah. Who is the coolest? Medvedev. He wins every single time, and Netflix goes ahead and portrays him as the villain. Honestly, F you, Netflix. Yeah. F you. You better That's not okay.
Yeah, and so my suggestion
That's
to
not
Netflix...
okay. It makes me really angry because it has... Because all the people in Indian Wells... Not all the people, I'm sorry.
A lot.
A lot of people in Indian Wells
watch
come to
series.
Watch Indian Wells, and maybe they have watched Breakpoint, but they are not in... Like, people who listen to the podcast probably, who are inside in all the freaking time in tennis. They don't know Medvedev is a great guy. They saw this and they think, oh, look at this asshole, and now he's egging on the crowd. Fits with the image, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And it's so unfair.
So here's my thing, and I love that you're getting that angry about it, and me too, because that is not right. And he is genuinely such a nice guy off the court. I can tell you that from my own personal experiences with him and conversations I've had with him. He is a great guy. He's caring. He always says hello. He's there for a hug. I mean, I don't know if anyone that follows me saw that little video I did after he won that match at 1 a.m. in the morning. And he plays along with stuff. He's nice. Anyway, I hope
Let me finish this one.
Yeah. When they do the Alcaraz thing next year, which they are doing now because they've been promoting it crazy, and so is Alcaraz, which is great. We've got them in tennis still with Alcaraz because it's going to be hopefully great. Do the right thing. If Alcaraz plays Medvedev again, or you show anything on Medvedev, please show him in the light that he truly is, which is a nice guy, not an asshole. So Netflix, thumbs down to you on that. And you might get a thumbs up from me if you portray him a little bit better in
or
the next
just what I ask. I don't even ask to portray him as a hero or the nicest guy in the world. Just show him in the full complexity that he is as a tennis player and a person, because we all are a multitude of things. We're not always the nice guy, not always. But if out of 100 guys in the locker room, 98 like you, and the one who doesn't is Zverev, and the other one is yourself... You have to question your portrayal of what you just did.
Exactly.
Insanity to me. That is insanity. Have you not talked to anybody in tennis? Have you not done that? So your narrative is more important to you. In a reality show, this is different.
Yeah.
If we're talking... This is
like
a docu-series. Yes.
Yeah.
This is not even a reality. This is a docu-series.
Yeah.
We're talking about a docu-series. If you're writing fiction... I write fiction. You can do whatever the fuck you want.
Yes,
but then you're
I
writing
know.
Fiction.
My name is different in your book.
Yeah, but you know what I mean? That's fiction. But if you do a docu-series, you have to talk to people. I know a few documentary filmers and I know a few documentary makers. They talk for years and months to people inside the sport or whatever it is in the realm
of what they are filming.
So they can gather a kind of sense of what this world is made about before they even go in filming.
Yep.
So this to me is an unacceptable thing, and I really hope they do him right, because so many people who are not inside tennis think he's an asshole now, and that's not okay.
So if I could explain to you the vein poppage from my friend here.
But isn't that unfair?
It is good.
Did people come up to you asking you like, oh, what a bad guy is Medvedev?
For sure. But so I'm going to explain to you the redness and the vein poppage out of my friend here. But we would like all of you that have thankfully listened to us, and you know, we'd love you for listening to us, is that you please spread the word that what was portrayed on Netflix when it comes to Medvedev is bullshit, okay? The guy is great. So please pass it on to all your tennis fans and all your tennis friends. So when you go and watch this guy play, please be supportive of him, because he is a master of being a great tennis player who's as gutsy as hell. And I love him. And he finishes a match at fucking 1 a.m. in the morning and comes the next day and gives 100%. And you should, as fans, appreciate this guy because he is the best. So anyway, on that note, should we clean it up and say...
We have to talk about Alcaraz a little bit.
The guy's unbelievable.
Well, I want to say two things about Alcaraz that I think are the reason why he won Indian Wells. Number one, even before the injury woos, he found patience again.
He didn't have patience. Absolutely.
He didn't have structure. He didn't have patience. We still saw the talent, but he didn't know how to build a point to win it. These guys are the best tennis players in the world. Your talent is not going to be enough.
Yep.
You need to build the point. And Jim Courier mentioned it over and over again. He said, oh, he found the patience again. And
he played correctly against Zverev.
Exactly.
He played correctly against Medvedev. He waited for the patient, the right shot. So you're perfect in that analogy.
That's number one. And number two, he also found his drop shot again.
Yep.
You mentioned it before.
Yep.
It he didn't have the feel for it. Yeah. I don't know what it was. Maybe he was rushing it. Maybe because he was lacking patience, he thought it has to be too good, so he missed it a lot. And this was the first tournament in a while where he really found, first of all, the perfect timing of when to play it, and second of all, the right positioning, not too risky, not too,
and
you know.
He was bombing his serve too. Yeah. He was serving better. And one thing also, and we love giving Jim credit, one thing that Jim also highlighted, one of the reasons why he was comparing great service, right? Mm-hmm. And why is it, for example, Novak's serve when he first started out was pretty shit. Mm. Okay, he would double fold, his elbow was too low, there's a lot of things going on, something that I think Goran has really helped him with. But he's an amazing spot server. Mm-hmm. So when you look at Novak's serve, now would I teach Novak's service motion? Absolutely not. I don't think it's a great service motion.
Same with Del Potro's forehand. You would never teach that. No, still, it was arguably the best forehand ever.
But he has figured out a way to hit his spots, and he aces more people than a lot of people do.
Well, interesting point in that. I ask a lot because I'm interested, because that's the one thing I can never gain insight on is playing men, because I only played the women. And there are things like, I know how it feels to play a Coco Gauff, you know, so it gives me a bit more insight on other things. I know how Sabalenka's ball feels in your racket. So this is really gives me a lot of insight, but I can't have that with men. So I like to ask players who have actively played Novak, for example.
What is it about them?
What is it about him? And every single person I ask says he serves really well, which wouldn't ever be the first thing that comes to your mind. But I think with everything else and him serving the spots and then his strength from the baseline really messes with your mind.
Yeah.
Because now you can't even get an in on his serve, which used to be a thing that you could maybe find a way in.
Particularly the second serve. And he would give you a double fault here and there, especially under pressure. But I think there's a couple of things. One, like Rafa has never been a big server, but whatever. But I think about, you know, the great servers, like even with Sinner, he's banging it down, but he's 6'4", whatever. You know, Carlos is not tall, but neither was Roger Federer. Roger's, what, 6'1", something like that? So a little, he's slightly taller than Carlos, but very similar in height. But Roger was an amazing spot server. So they did a diagnosis of where they serve as far as the Hawkeye. And Roger's was always like super close to the line, as is Novak's, right? So when you're talking about two guys of the same height, Roger and Carlos, Carlos's spots are nowhere near as good. They are like a good foot from the sideline, right? So he's hitting it good and he's hitting it big and all that sort of stuff, but he's not hitting it close to the line, whereas Roger would hit it really close to the line. So I think one area that he can improve on is his spot serving. And Jim suggested, you just got to take the cans, man. Put the cans down like we all do as professionals, and you got to hit that can over and over and over and over again on the line or just before the line, and not a foot from the line, because that allows a Sinner, a Medvedev, you know, a Runa, a Novak, it allows them to get the return back into the court. And if you're playing on a fast court and that ball's coming back over and over again, at some point you're going to lose your serve. Whereas on a fast court particularly, you should be able to hit those spots and get free points, which Novak does, which Sinner does, you know, which all these, you know, big servers do, and Carlos doesn't. So he has to work so hard for his points. And so that's one area that he can improve on, and that's why he'll win more on a fast court. I mean, yes, he won Wimbledon, but to be honest, I was there live for that match. He served incredibly well in that match against Novak. So that's where he was getting free points.
Well there, yeah.
So that's an area that he can improve on, because everything else is fantastic.
Yeah.
The guy is so good for the sport. The fact that he loses points and smiles and he's
just
enthusiasm,
one thing I have to say.
I love him.
Yeah, but there is one thing.
That
he's a play
you?
Child. He's a play child.
What does that mean?
He's a play child. He cannot just... He multiple times yesterday, because he was so much better than Medvedev in the second. Yes.
Okay.
You have a ball, kill it. If you play best of five, you can't be playing drop shot lob for the next. Maybe he won't do it in best of five, but that costs him matches because he's a play child. He has to get rid a little bit, not of the whole play child, but he has to get rid of 5% of the play child.
But it's where he finds, and I think this is important, I agree.
5%. I'm not saying the whole play child, just 5%.
I agree. But the thing that I love about it is that he loves entertaining.
He does.
And he loves the play. He loves the screaming and the you know, the getting the crowd into it and the hand behind the ear, like, I can't hear you. And it's not done with like malice. It's so he loves the show.
He loves
it. And it's very similar to Roger. Roger loved the show as well. And Roger obviously had the talent to ooze like Novak in Alcaraz in a lot of ways, where he could hit this and he could slice that and he could hit a tweener and all this stuff. And he loved that. And that's actually what made Roger enjoy the sport for so long. So I want him to keep the play child, to love the sport and continue to work hard and love the sport. Maybe 2% less.
Roger never had that be in the way of winning a match.
That's right. Yep.
Carlos sometimes does.
Do you think that
now he didn't?
But he's 21. What is he, 20?
Roger was 19 when he came up, and he never had that. So that's the only thing I'm saying.
How many Grand Slams had Roger won by 21?
Zero.
Jesco, can you look that up for us?
I think he won his first when he was 21.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, if he's got the play, and he's won two slams. And he's dominating ATP 1000s as well at his age. I don't know.
I'm all for the play child. I think it's so important to get the crowd in. I just think sometimes he's won four until he was two.
No, how many?
He was 22 when he won his first.
So there you go. Thank you, Jesse. So 22 years of age. He's already won two slams. Okay. And he's where he's at. He's been number one in the world. And you think about that. So I want him to keep the play child. Just don't play child when you're playing against the best of the best, as in Novak and Medvedev and Sinner, when you can finish the point a little bit earlier. And also, it's just less miles on your own legs.
Yeah. Right? Well, I just think if he can streamline it a little bit, because we saw, and I said that, and it's interesting, we had this discussion before.
I'm going to get that t-shirt made, play child.
Play child. But we had this discussion before, and I think the difference in on a slower hard court between Sinner and Alcaraz was that Alcaraz has more variety. Yep. And Sinner tried, but it's not natural to him yet. But that's the amazing thing about Jannik. He improves month in, month out. Yeah. You see him every month, and he has incorporated something new into his game. And this is great that he will get more. And he said it actually in the press conference. He said, I got too predictable. I played good. I played well. I played so well in the first set, but I got too predictable. And Carlos never is. So the play child is strong. Just reduce it by 5%.
I also think that Jannik just stopped hitting his backhand down the line in the second set and stopped being a little bit aggressive early. And then Alcaraz got into the match and then it was sort of over. But it was a joy to watch all these matches, all these players. We've got so much depth in
just
tennis.
Just terrible weather.
Terrible weather. But you know what? We're so used to that in Indian Wells where I played a doubles final there 1 year and I did not warm up for the final, which is unheard of. I mean, that's unheard of, right? I went into the gym, I ran, I got a sweat. My only warm-up was the 5 minutes before the match because the wind was so bad. The only ever time that's happened to me was Doha, similar conditions,
they have
the
desert,
right?
Desert winds.
We get the desert storms. Literally, that's where desert storms come from. So I was playing with Kofeta Peshke in Doha and we walked out and we went, well, what's the point? And then I was playing with Lisa in Indian Wells and we didn't warm up. So the wind out there can be friggin' awful. And then of course we had rain and we had bees and it was like a plague had hit Indian Wells. But what didn't hit Indian Wells in plague was the level of tennis that everyone played, considering how bad the conditions were.
Absolutely.
So just a congrats on everyone out there for just giving us everything. It'll be interesting to see how slow or fast Miami is. It's all about the sand granulars that they put into when they lay down the court, how much sand gets into the court. And of course in Indian Wells, it's almost natural that sand is going to be more involved in the court because of the sand out in the desert. It literally, if you ever go out there and they show that big drone shot, you see the sand like blowing around. It's like it gets in your eyes out there. So that's also going to get into the mix on the court. So it slows the court down a lot. It'll be interesting to see how quick Miami is. We'll have a fairly good idea after a few days and we'll hear from the players. But overall, it was a great couple of weeks. Petco, you are heading down to Miami.
I am. I'm flying
in like
out
a couple of hours.
Yes.
Working for Tennis Channel. So we can't wait to listen to you down there. I will be here listening to you and your.
You should come down.
Lovely tones. Maybe I will.
Why don't you come down and we can just
have a little couple of days in the sun.
And we can do every 2 days one podcast.
Okay, well, let's see how
because
I feel.
Because we do podcasts for pop stars.
We do. Guys, thanks for listening to us today. We love bringing it to you with the sights and sounds of Brooklyn behind us with the ambulance and loud trucks.
Yeah, sorry for that. It's just
No, it's
New
fine.
York.
We've got excellent microphones thanks to Jesse Katansky, our producer, and your boyfriend, who's awesome. So anyway, thanks for listening to us all, guys. We'll be back soon, I promise. And thanks for hanging in with us. I know you come at me and Petco like, when's the next pod? It's more about Petco than me. So you can blame her. But guys, thanks for listening to us today. We love you guys. And should we say tschüss? Now we're in the US.
We should just say
Bye. Bye. Let's just do
bye.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.